The Untold History Channel. My name is Ron Parkane. It is Monday. Is it the 10th? The 10th of June? I can't even hardly believe it. I don't know. I have to like double check all the dates. I don't hardly pay attention anymore. But it is the 10th of June. And I've got, excuse me, I'm kind of distracted here. I have a couple of friends. My little one here, Charlie, crawling all over, and then Remington right over there. So you will probably see them. They are they're glued to me today. I don't know. Everywhere I go, they go. So, but anyway, it is. I decided to start a little bit early today because I wanted to see if I could get through a little bit more of the. Of this Eisenhower book. So let's go ahead and just jump right in. So we finished up with him giving his, I believe we finished up with his Atoms for Peace thing, which really was just was like a global warming, climate change of the day type thing, handing over control. Oh no, buddy! Don't do that. Handing over control to the of the United States, you know, to the United Nations. We're all going to die. We're going to die unless we hand over control to the United Nations. So yeah, similar thing, kind of what they're trying to do with the Paris Peace Accords and all other shit. So you know, as they say, nothing new under the sun. So this is we are now in February of 1954. Let's see. In 1953, a proposal known as the Bricker Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was introduced in the U.S. Senate. The sponsor, Senator John Bricker, Republican from Ohio, had been a strong supporter of his fellow Ohioan, the now dead Robert Taft, and was also a string backer of Joseph McCarthy. Bricker's amendment proposed that no treaty signed by the United States could override the U.S. Constitution or infringe upon the liberties guaranteed to American citizens in the Bill of Rights. The idea drew the support of the majority of Republican senators and even many Democrats. The Council on Foreign Relations was quick to denounce the Bricker Amendment by running a 19-page hit piece in its quarterly journal for the elite Foreign Affairs. CFR man Eisenhower obediently fell into line, fronting for his New York masters and calling the amendment backers nuts and crackpots. Ike's sycophant biographer Stephen Ambrose informs us of Ike's obsession with killing the patriotic initiative. Eisenhower used all his persuasive powers in stag dinners, at meetings, in private, in correspondence, even on the golf course to kill the amendment. To circumvent the massive Republican support for the amendment, Ike relied upon and worked closely with the utterly contemptible Senator Minority Leader and future President Lyndon Johnson. It was LBJ's job to strong-arm Senate Democrats, many of which had previously supported the Bricker Amendment. And so it came to pass that a perfectly reasonable measure to protect Americans from potential global communist subversion from above was killed by Baruch's puppet president, falling just one vote shy of the necessary two-thirds supermajority needed to pass a constitutional amendment pending approval of enough states. You know what? I kind of like feel like I read that last time, but I don't think I really truly grasped it. I think it was like towards the very end of, and I was kind of like, I was at my wits. I don't say I was at my wits end, but I was just kind of tired and anyway, long story short is I don't think I really truly understood that. And man, that's crazy. So they wanted to put in a constitutional amendment that made it so that no treaty that the country ever signed would ever violate the Constitution. Hmm. Kind of like similar to getting on board with the United Nations gun grabbing and, you know, that violating the Second Amendment of the United States. So very interesting. And, you know, obviously not a shocker that Eisenhower said, no, can't do that. To investigate growing allegations of subversion by the large tax-exempt foundations, Congress established the Reese Committee. You know, this is interesting timing, because it was last week when I was talking about the, when I was talking about the World War One conspiracy, and how James Corbett had done the show afterwards, and he had a clip of the video that G. Edward Griffin had interviewed Norman Dodd, and Norman Dodd was the primary person doing the investigative work on the Reese Committee. And so anyway, this is, I'm going to read this again. To investigate growing allegations of subversion by the large tax-exempt foundations, Congress established the Reese Committee. The almighty Council on Foreign Relations even came under congressional scrutiny for the first and last time. The committee's report claimed that the major foundations were heavily funding public propaganda and manipulating education to promote internationalism in a form directed toward world government and derogation. Did I say that correctly? To promote internationalism in a form directed toward world government and a derogation of American nationalism. The report also declared that the CFR was, in essence, an agency of the United States government, and that its productions are directed overwhelmingly to promote the globalist concept. Oh, hey, buddy. It had with the Bricker Amendment, the globalists working through their wholly owned media and their wholly owned puppet President Eisenhower, who in turn operated through frontman Congressman Wayne Hayes, a left-wing Ohio Democrat known for his nastiness, maneuver to undermine the Reese Committee from within. Renee Wormser, counsel to the committee, later wrote that Mr. Hayes told us one day that the White House had been in touch with him and asked him if he would cooperate to kill the Reese Committee. And killed, or rather allowed to fade away, it was. And the left-wing foundations are still up to their dirty tricks of funding human rights causes, education initiatives, and pro-democracy movements to this very day, which is why a number of them were recently kicked out of nationalist Russia and China. And I'll just say that, you know, I'm just going to add, just to I know a little bit about the Reese Committee because I've actually read that thing. It's been a minute since I read it, but it, essentially what Norman Dodd said is that they were they were very open and honest about what their stated goal was, which was to basically merge the United States and the Soviet Union. That was what their objective was. They wanted to bring them together. They wanted to turn America communist, basically. Just 8 months after ending the Korean War, in which he abandoned U.S. POWs, Eisenhower began America's unnecessary involvement in Vietnam. In February of 54, he had refused to commit American troops to the Franco-Vietnamese War, stating in a press conference, "I cannot conceive of a greater tragedy for America than to get heavily involved now in an all-out war in any of those regions." By April, however, double-dealing, Ike had authorized military aid to the French. After the defeated France left Vietnam in disgrace, Eisenhower administration aided Ngo Dinh Diem in consolidating power in Saigon, or South Vietnam, throughout the remainder of his presidency, Eisenhower remained committed to propping up Diem's regime in a divided nation. It was at the start of his interference in Vietnam in April 7th of 1954, to be precise, that Eisenhower coined one of the most famous phrases of the Cold War when he suggested that the fall of the French Indochina to the communists could create a domino effect in Southeast Asia. The so-called domino theory dominated U.S. thinking about Vietnam for the next decade. In the most childish terms imaginable, the vile deceiver suddenly switched gears, explaining before Congress and the nation, you have a row of dominoes set up, you knock over the first one, and what will happen to the last is a certainty that it will go over very quickly. He added that the loss of Indochina, of Burma, of Thailand, of the peninsula, and Indonesia would follow, even suggested that Japan would be in danger. Now a communist sympathizer like Eisenhower could not possibly care less if Southeast Asia adopted a Marxist political economic system. North Vietnamese leader Ho Chi Minh was more of an independent-minded nationalist than he was a pure Marxist anyway. Indeed, it was Eisenhower's support for divided Vietnam that drove the nationalist leaders of North Vietnam closer to the Soviet-Chinese axis. On an August 28, 2012, New York Times headline for a book review of Embers of War, The Fall of an Empire and the Making of America's Vietnam by the Cornell University professor and historian Frederick Lojval asked, did the United States lose Ho Chi Minh to communism? An excerpt from the book review. Ho was clearly admiring of the Americans in 1945, and he actively sought their help. As a sweetener, he had allowed some of the men under General Giap to rescue downed American pilots. Major Thomas, who died in 2005 after a long career as an attorney in Lansing, Michigan, radioed his OSS superiors based in Kunming in southwestern China that they needn't worry about Ho's political leanings. Forget the communist bogey, he wrote. Viet Minh League is not communist, stands for freedom and reforms from French harshness. History has been so badly distorted. Ike wasn't containing the spread of international communism in Vietnam. At the time of Ike's domino speech, Ho and his boys were anti-colonialist nationalists with no particular hard feelings toward America. Yes, they were socialists, but not communist internationalists hostile to America. Ike changed all that by pushing the North Vietnamese into Soviet arms, and it was by design. By alienating nationalists like Ho Chi Minh, Ike actually assisting world communism as it had in Europe during and after World War II. Read Lojval's analysis and ask yourself if Ho Chi Minh was truly an enemy of America in 1954. The geopolitical game in Vietnam, as it was in Korea, was never about stopping communism. The purpose was to keep America bogged down in endless no-win wars against the exaggerated foreign boogeyman of Soviet communism. This is not to suggest that the Soviet Union was... Oops. Sorry, guys. I had my keyboard laid down there, and she jumped on it. And it totally destroyed my screen here. Oh, let me get back. Here we go. Okay, got it back. Let's see here. The geopolitical game in Vietnam, as it was in Korea, was never about stopping communism. The purpose was to keep America bogged down in endless no-win wars against the exaggerated foreign boogeyman of Soviet communism. This is not to suggest the Soviet Union was not a real adversary of course, but the true communist threat was domestic all along. Under Ike's protection, this cancer, under the guise of liberalism, continued to spread like cancer throughout America's political, journalistic, and academic institutions. Ike's announcement of the fraudulent domino theory laid the foundation for the future President Lyndon Johnson and his own CFR crew, based on a hoax attack at Tonkin Gulf, to escalate U.S. involvement to full-blown combat. The unnecessary Vietnam War would result in the deaths of 60,000 mostly drafted young Americans while stirring up social unrest domestically, though only 10 of those deaths occurred during the Eisenhower years. The fact remains that it was Eisenhower who pushed the formerly pro-American Ho Chi Minh into the sphere of the Soviets when he could have easily made friends with him. He's not the first president to do that. Apparently, as I understand it, Ho Chi Minh actually wanted to meet with the Wilson delegation in Paris after at the Treaty of Versailles, because he wanted to talk. He loved the United States. In fact, I think if memory serves, what he wanted to do is he wanted to create a constitution based for the government in Vietnam, based almost exclusively on the American Constitution. Let's see. And then slowly but surely, the anti-communist Eisenhower drew us deeper and deeper into the Vietnam quagmire. Again, just 8 months after ending the Korean War in the most shameful manner. As for John F. Kennedy, the true anti-communist president who served in between the scoundrels Eisenhower and Johnson, he never bought into Ike's phony domino theory nonsense and was committed to pulling all advisors out of Vietnam. His murder at the hands of the clandestine party's CIA ended any talk of pulling out of Vietnam. The Bilderberg Group is an annual unofficial invitation-only conference of about 150 elite globalists from America and Europe. All of the existing guests at the exclusive resorts are notified to leave before the Bilderbergers arrive in town. The Bilderberg One Worlders are all people of great influence in the fields of politics, banking, intelligence, business, military, and media. The secret conferences are held in a different location every year. No press releases are ever issued. The group takes its name from the Bilderberg Hotel in Holland, where the first meeting was held. Members of the Rothschild and Rockefeller crime dynasties have attended every year since its inception. Club Bilderberg has a history of inviting little-known politicians and then catapulting them to fame and office within a short time. For example, Bill Clinton attended a 1991 Bilderberg meeting in Germany while he was barely known governor of Arkansas. The following year, he was media hyped into the White House. The Bilderbergers are a relatively well-known among modern-day conspiracy theorists. What is not known, come here, buddy. That's a good point. What is not well known is that President Eisenhower, who used the powers of his office, including the CIA, to initiate this annual criminal conference of the New World Order that is still going strong to this day. I did not know that. Wow. So it was Eisenhower who helped start the Bilderberg Group. Boy, that's something right there. That's really something. A persistent Eisenhower myth that has received much recent attention from misguided conservatives is the mistaken belief that Ike was tough on illegal immigration. As evidence for this fallacy, the Fox News crowd likes to cite Operation Wetback, the forced deportation of somewhere between 500,000 to a million illegal Mexican workers and their families. Estimates vary greatly because so many soon came back. Beginning in World War II, during a severe shortage of workers out on the home front, the federal government instituted the Bracero program, which brought Mexican workers into the United States to fill jobs that would not otherwise be filled. The Braceros were in the country legally, but the government often looked the other way when companies, in order to get around the bureaucratic aspects of the program, illegally brought their own Mexican workers into the country. It is important to note that unlike so many of the illegal aliens of today, those of the 1954 were not welfare parasites. Expensive free stuff such as food stamps, public housing, Medicaid, Pell Grants, energy assistance programs, earned income tax credits, etc. None of that was given. None of that was even in existence at that time. Furthermore, given the low unemployment rate of 1954, 5.5%, and the unappealing nature of the agricultural jobs which the migrants worked at, no one could say that they were stealing U.S. jobs, or at least not in any significant numbers. So then, if the hardworking Mexicans, mainly from the border areas of Texas and California, weren't costing U.S. taxpayers one thin dime and weren't denying American citizens of job opportunities, then what prompted the deportation program, Operation Wetback? Are you ready for this, Fox News fans? Operation Wetback originated from a request by the Mexican government to stop the illegal entry of Mexican laborers into the United States. Constant pressure from Mexican land and farm owners prompted the Mexican government to call a meeting in Mexico City with four agencies of the U.S. government, the Department of Justice, the Department of State, the INS, and the Border Patrol. This meeting resulted in increased border patrol along the U.S.-Mexico border by the Truman administration. You see, Mexico at that time needed the labor. That is why they put so much pressure on the United States. Eisenhower, the immigration enforcer, deported Mexicans not to help America, but to pacify the Mexican government. In spite of this, immigration continued. One of the main issues was that the deported Mexicans rapidly re-entered the United States. To prevent this, Mexico and America developed a strategy to deport Mexicans deeper into Mexican territory by a system of planes, boats, and trains. In 1954, negotiations surrounding the Bronco program broke down, prompting the Mexican government to send troops to its border with the United States. Eisenhower had to act. He appointed General Joseph Swing as INS commissioner and charged him with resolving border control issues in order to stabilize labor negotiations with Mexico. Overall, there were about a million apprehensions made in the first year of Wetback. In addition, many illegal immigrants fled to Mexico fearing arrest. The total number of apprehensions fell to just 240,000 in 1955 and would continuously decline year after year. During the entirety of the operation, border recruitment of illegal workers by American growers continued due largely to the low cost of illegal labor and the desire of growers to avoid the bureaucratic obstacles of Bracero. The continuation of illegal immigration was largely responsible for the eventual failure of the program. The name Wetback was a disparaging term applied to illegal immigrants who had sneaked into the United States by swimming the Rio Grande. It became a derogatory term applied generally to Mexican laborers, including those who were legal residents. In addition to having been initiated to please Mexico and ultimately failing, the tactical execution of Operation Wetback was, at times, brutal and inhumane. Again, these aren't welfare parasites and criminals who were harmed, but just hardworking people, some with families. One of the biggest problems for the deportees was sending them to unfamiliar parts of Mexico where they struggled to find their way. Those apprehended were often deported without getting a chance to recover their property in the United States or to contact their families. They were often stranded without any food when they were dumped in Mexico. Deported Mexicans sometimes faced extreme conditions in their country. In July of 1955, due to neglect by the Mexican government, 88 deported workers died in the 112 degree Fahrenheit heat. And finally, Wetback wasn't just a deportation program. Apart from ultimately breaking down and failing, the program created more legal immigration opportunities. Indeed, far from being tough on immigration, Eisenhower, the globalist, right from the earliest days of his presidency, as we've already witnessed with it, with regard to his attack upon on the popular McCarran-Walter Act, actively used the powers of his office to undermine reasonable immigration restrictions. No globalist believes in national borders. Damn. The 1954 Guatemalan coup was yet another covert operation carried out by the Eisenhower gang. The coup, codenamed Operation PB Success, deposed the democratically elected president Jacobo Arbenz and installed the military dictatorship of Carlos Castillo Armas. Alan Dulles, the CIA, armed, funded, and trained a force of 500 men led by Armas in textbook CIA fashion. The coup was preceded by an intense U.S. propaganda campaign to criticize and isolate Guatemala internationally. The force then invaded Guatemala on June 18, 1954. The subsequent campaign of psychological warfare included bombings of Guatemala City and a fake news radio station claiming to be genuine. Although the invasion force was initially defeated, the psychological warfare and the threat of a U.S. invasion so intimidated the Guatemalan army that they eventually refused to fight. Arbenz attempted to arm civilians to resist a possible U.S. invasion before resigning on June 27th. Carlos Armas became president two weeks later following U.S.-sponsored negotiations. The ridiculous pretext for the coup was the false charge that Arbenz, although a socialist, was an agent of the Russians in Central America. It was Eisenhower's phony domino theory again, this time with a Monroe Doctrine twist. So, if anti-communism wasn't the true motive behind the coup, what was? The United Fruit Company, whose highly profitable business had been affected by the end to exploitative labor practices in Guatemala, wanted Arbenz out. To that end, UFC engaged in an intense lobbying campaign to persuade Truman and later on Eisenhower to overthrow his government. Arbenz's real offense was to confiscate unused land owned by United Fruit Company to redistribute it to rural poor under a land reform. And I think it should probably be noticed, he may talk about it here in a minute, but the United Fruit Company was basically a CIA front. During the 1930s, it was the Secretary of State John Foster Dulles' law firm, Sullivan & Cromwell, that negotiated the land giveaways to the United Fruit Company in Guatemala. His CIA brother, Alan, also did legal work for United Fruit Company and sat on its board of directors in a flagrant conflict of interest. The Dulles brothers and Sullivan & Cromwell remained on the United Front Company's payroll for 38 years. Henry Cabot Lodge, Eisenhower's ambassador to the United Nations, was a big owner of United Fruit Company stock. Ed Whitman, the United Fruit Company, UFC, public relations man, was married to Ann Whitman, Eisenhower's personal secretary, whose affair stunk to high heaven. Eisenhower's very strange anti-communist Guatemalan coup was condemned internationally and led to years of on and off civil war in that poor country. The event would fuel anti-American sentiment throughout Central and South America for decades to come, so much so that President Bill Clinton felt compelled to issue a phony expression of regret in 1999. Should also notice that, looking here where it talks about Sullivan and Cromwell, Sullivan and Cromwell was basically a Sullivan and Cromwell was kind of like the intelligence arm of the country, but for institution like the Council on Foreign Relations. And then when the CIA was created, basically what they did was they handed off all of the things that Sullivan and Cromwell was working on to the CIA, thus making the CIA, whatever the CIA did, it was essentially sanctioned by the government. So it took whatever was happening in the private world of law firms, Sullivan and Cromwell, and it it made it so that it was being done with government assistance or appear to be government sanctioned by CIA. So, let's see. Yeah, I just read that. Okay. 13 months after anti-communist Supreme Court Chief Justice Fred Vinson had died of a heart attack at age 63, Justice Robert Jackson also died of a heart attack at 62. Conservapedia writes of Jackson, Justice Robert Jackson was perhaps the finest Supreme Court jurist of the 20th century, despite having never attended college or having a law degree. He was widely known to be a brilliant conservative judge. Eisenhower then named precedent John Harlan to the court to replace Jackson in just his second year as president, thanks to two very convenient heart attacks of relatively young and healthy men. Eisenhower has already moved the Supreme Court to the left. Again, as with the sudden and very convenient deaths of Senator Taft and Justice Vinson, we cannot recklessly scream murder over the sudden death of Justice Jackson. All we can say is that the sudden and coincidental death rash of relatively young and important anti-communist conservative sure is intriguing. That is true. We know about Ike's communist brother and confidant, Milton, but another one of his brothers, an attorney named Edgar Eisenhower, had a very different worldview from his brothers Dwight and Milton. On the eve of the Democrats' success in the 1954 midterm congressional elections, Edgar wrote a letter to his brother in which he took the president to task for acting like a Democrat. The most shocking excerpt. For your information, there are a great many people in all walks of life with whom I have talked who have made the statement that there is very little difference between the policies of your administration and that of the former administration. In his immediate and strongly worded response to his conservative brother, in which Dwight mocked Edgar for harping on the Constitution and dismissing his Republican critics as stupid, Ike recited a few conservative-sounding slogans, but then them into irrelevancy by parroting the liberal line. He revealed beliefs that he wouldn't dare utter publicly before other Republicans. We'll let the key excerpts from the letter speak for themselves. November 8, 1954, letter to Edgar. Dear Ed, I think that such answer as I can give to you or to your letter of November 1st will be arranged in reverse order. At least I shall comment on I'll comment first on your final paragraph. You keep harping on the Constitution. I should like to point out that the meaning of the Constitution is what the Supreme Court says it is. Holy shit. I admit the Supreme Court has in the past made certain decisions in this general field that have been astonishing to me. But until some future Supreme Court decision denies the right and responsibilities of the federal government to do certain things, you cannot possibly remove them from the political activities of the federal government. Now, it is true that I believe this country is following a dangerous trend when it permits too great a degree of centralization of government functions. I oppose this. In some instances, the fight is a rather desperate one, but to attain any success, it is quite clear that the federal government cannot avoid or escape responsibilities which has the mass of people firmly believe should be undertaken by it. The political processes of our country are such that if a rule of reason is not applied in this effort, we will lose everything. This is what I mean by my constant insistence upon moderation in government. Should any political party attempt to abolish Social Security, unemployment insurance, and eliminate labor laws and farm programs, you would not hear that party again in our political history. There is a tiny splinter group, of course, that believe you can only do these things. Among them are H.L. Hunt. You possibly know this, his background, and few other Texas oil millionaires, and an occasional politician or businessman from another areas. Their number is negligible, and they are stupid. To say, therefore, that in some instances, the policies of this administration have not been radically changed from those of the last is perfectly true. But in all government fields of action, a combination of purpose, procedure, and objectives must be considered if you are to get a true evaluation of the relative merits. This being true, how can anyone be so unaware of what is happening as to say that this administration has conducted foreign affairs under the same policies as did the former administration? As a matter of fact, if you will press any individuals who bring to you the all these strictures and comments, I venture that your experience will be the same as mine. That experience is that these individuals have no idea what the foreign policy of the previous administration was and what the present one is. They've heard certain slogans such as giveaway programs. They have no slightest idea as to what has been the effect of these programs in sustaining American security and prosperity. Moreover, they have no idea whatsoever as to comparative size of them now as compared to even 2 or 3 years ago. You say that these critics also complain about the continuance of controls, presumably over our economy. There is nothing in your letter that shows such complete ignorance as to what has actually happened, as does this term. When we came into office, there were federal controls exercised over prices, wages, rents, as well as all over the allocation and use of raw materials. The first thing this administration did was to set about to eliminate all of those controls. You talk also about bad political advice. I am getting, I always assumed that lawyers attempted accuracy in their statements. How do you know that I'm getting any political advice? Next, if I do get political advice, how do you know that it is not weighted in the direction that you seem to think it should be? Although I am tempted at times to believe that you are just thrashing around rather than thinking anything through to a definite conclusion. So how can you say I'm getting bad advice? Why don't you just assure I am, or why don't you just assume I am stupid, trying to wreck the nation and leave our Constitution in tatters? I assure you that you have more reason, based on 64 years of contact, to say this than you do to make the bland assumption that I am surrounded by a group of Machiavellian characters who are seeking the downfall of the United States and the ascendancy of socialism and communism in the world. Finally, I must assure you again that I am delighted to get your own honest criticisms, particularly if you will only take the trouble to lay down the facts on which you reach what seem to me some remarkable conclusions. But the mere repetition of aphorisms and political slogans and newspaper headlines leaves me cold. I am sorry you were not going to be at Abilene. It would be easier to tell you these things than to write them, except that this method, I hope, make you a little thinking rather than devote yourself just to the whining of a noisy argument, as ever. P.S. I attach a paragraph and a cartoon that came to me in the same mail as did your letter. At least it represents a different viewpoint. Incidentally, it comes from one of the most successful businessmen in the nation. So it just says here that Edgar and Dwight brothers did not see eye to eye, at least not politically. Brother Edgar Eisenhower, he was nothing like Brother Milton. November 54, the media's relentless attacks on Joe McCarthy and the majority Republican Party, combined with Eisenhower's deliberate sabotage of the great senator and conservative Republicans, cost the GOP 18 seats in the House of Representatives, giving the Democrats a majority that they would retain in every House election until 1994. Holy shit. 30 years. I remember growing up as a kid. And it was like, it was just a guarantee that the Democrats were going to have Congress. I remember the speaker was Tip O'Neill, and it was just always a, it was going to be a Democrat Congress no matter what. I mean, that was just, that was a, it was a given. In the Senate, the Republicans lost two seats, enough to flip the majority from R to D and position the vicious villain Lyndon Baines Johnson as Senate Majority Leader. Senate Democrats would hold that advantage until 1981. And yet, Eisenhower himself, thanks to the press, remained extremely popular. Besides besides media hype of Ike and media bashing of the Republicans, what else accounted for this weird paradox? From the very beginning of his presidency, Ike and his clique of crypto commies ruthlessly and systematically rooted out Taft conservatives from positions of influence within the Republican Party. Taft's oh-so-convenient and sudden death in 1953 greatly facilitated this effort. Author-activist Robert Welch explains what role this played in the Republican debacle of 1954. I'm going to pause it here for a second here. Just give me a second, guys. 1 second. All right, I actually had to turn the air conditioner off. It was getting cold. The violent opposition of the Eisenhower administration to Joe McCarthy and the Bricker Amendment brought on first lethargy in what were normally the hardest working units of party machinery. This showed up especially in a failure to raise money, and they brought on, second, a stay-at-home tendency on the part of millions of conservatives on Election Day, which visibly decided many of the important outcomes. At the close of 1952, the Democrat globalist communist axis of evil had been on life support. Now, just 2 years later, Senator Majority Leader Robert Taft was dead. Senator John Bricker was neutralized. Senator Joe McCarthy was declawed. The conservative Republican activists and donors were demoralized, and the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, all exactly as Eisenhower and the powers above him had intended. At the pinnacle of his power, Senator McCarthy's high-profile hearings had attracted a huge national following. His supporters, including the Kennedy family, such popular, posed a threat to the communists and to their globalist enablers. When McCarthy began inching up the ladder toward the bigger players, the media big guns were brought out to stop him. In March of 54, CBS legend Edward R. Murrow, a personal friend of CBS CEO Bill Paley, dedicated an entire show to attacking McCarthy. The following week, Murrow ran yet another hit piece. The accumulation of TV and newspaper venom aimed at McCarthy took a toll on his image. Colleagues began to shun McCarthy as President Eisenhower plotted against him. In December of 54, 1 month after the congressional elections, the Senate officially censored McCarthy. The Democrats overwhelmingly condemned McCarthy. It was a bunch of Eisenhower moderate Republican allies who initiated and led the effort to humiliate and silence the American hero. Among Ike's lynch mob was Ralph Flanders, Republican for Vermont, Margaret Chase Smith, Republican from Maine, and patriarch of the Bush family, Prescott Bush, Republican of Connecticut. This marked the end of McCarthy's crusade against the globalist communist axis. It was Eisenhower who hated McCarthy that engineered and censured while keeping his hands clean of it. In so doing, he not only protected globalism communism as he had done in World War II, but he had inflicted enormous damage upon the Republican Party, or at least its constitutional conservative wing. Under the reign of Eisenhower in 1955, ex-Senator ex-U.S. Senator, Republican for Vermont, Eisenhower. Ex-U.S. Senator, a Republican from Vermont. I think he missed it out there. Eisenhower supporter, federal judges Ernest Gibson ordered Lucille Miller sent to a private insane asylum. Later on, she was shipped out to another hospital in Washington, D.C. Her political writings were cited by the district attorney in his motion as his reason for believing that she was insane. The arrest, carried out after the tear gassing of the Miller family and subsequent prosecution had initiated, it was claimed because Miller had once urged a young man to challenge the legitimacy of Harry Truman's peacetime draft, a supposed federal offense. The real reason for the abuse of Lucille Miller in 1955 had nothing to do with her. With her advice to local young men to resist the draft. No, what got Mrs. Miller into trouble, as you will recall from the previous section, was her tireless crusade against the local communists. More specifically, her shocking claims about these known communists' love for Eisenhower. Again, the pertinent excerpt from Robert Welch's Politician. Robert Welch is the guy who started, he was president of the John Birch Society. Way up in Vermont, in and near the small town of Bethel, were the retreats of such well-known communists as Lee Pressman, Nathan Witt, Marion Bachrach, and John Abt. There was a whole huge nest of them, and in 1952, a patriotic but not too cautious Vermont woman, Lucille Miller, began to point out and do her best to get others to pay attention to the fact that every one of these communists was actively supporting Eisenhower campaign. And then, but 3 years later, in actions based on other charges before a federal judge who had himself been one of the objects of her criticism and in which Mrs. Miller was denied her constitutional rights, she was railroaded to St. Elizabeth's Hospital for the Insane in Washington. Eventually, some influential and public-minded citizens arranged for her release. By the way, Abt, Pressman, and Witt had worked with Milton Eisenhower at FDR's Marxist Agricultural Department. No, Mrs. Miller, you were most certainly not crazy. The interstate highway system for which Eisenhower is credited is named Dwight D. Eisenhower National System of Interstate and Defense Highways. The multi-year project begun in 1956 is one of the first things people think about today when they hear the name Eisenhower. Though Eisenhower championed the idea, it was not his own. One of Ike's mentors, the aforementioned General John Pershing, officially proposed the concept to Congress back in 1922 as a defense proposal. The Eisenhower plan was clearly based on the Pershing map of 1922. The highway system was originally conceived for the facilitation of moving men and material during wartime, or perhaps to make it easier for a one-world army to one day occupy America. The public travel benefit that the system would go on to serve was cited as a factor, but was not the main purpose. Hence, the term defense highways embedded in the official name. So let us dispense with giving exaggerated credit to Eisenhower as if he was some visionary ahead of his time. For this useful and necessary infrastructure, which would inevitably have been built anyway, as the nation's population, economy, and rate of automobile ownership all grew steadily during the post-war years, the idea was never Ike's, and in fairness, he himself never claimed that it was. Not only did the system occupy the Pershing map of 1922, but Ike, as an occupying general during World War II, had also been impressed with the German Autobahn highway system that had been built under Hitler, a system which ironically made it easier for mechanized divisions to occupy and subdue Germany. What should be troubling to the self-professed free market Republicans who ionize Eisenhower is the fact that one of Ike's other hidden motivations for the beginning of construction of the interstate system smacked of pure Keynesian Marxist ideology. Stephen Ambrose, Ike's sycophant biographer, in his biography of Eisenhower, cited as a factor. It was a public works program on a massive scale, indeed the largest public works program in history, which meant that the government could put millions of men to work without subjugating itself to the criticism that this was make work of the Depression era WPA or PWA variety. By tailoring expenditures for highways to the state of the economy, Eisenhower could use the program to flatten out the peaks and valleys of in unemployment. Ambrose elaborated on this point. One of Eisenhower's favorite programs for reducing the peaks and valleys of the GNP chart was the interstate system. Back in November 55, the president had talked to economic advisor Gabriel Hogg, who then informed Secretary of Commerce Sinclair Weeks that he wanted Commerce to plan the use of the interstate system for managing the economy. As Haig put it, that was the fundamental purpose of the plan in the initial instance. Emphasis added, this is neither the time nor place to argue for the supremacy of a free economy over the folly of central planned booms and busts. The main point to digest here is that one of Eisenhower's strongest motives for promoting the highway system was macroeconomic manipulation. This again demonstrates that he was a left-wing FDR Democrat Marxist deceitfully masquerading as a Republican. In a day and age when the concept of rigging the economy was still considered destructive and dangerous by the vast majority of Republicans. I've never heard that before. And if I'm not sure when this map was given, but that's correct. I don't know if it's like today or, yeah, this is a recent map because I can tell. And the reason I can tell is because of this little line right here. And there's one right here too. These are recent. That wasn't like in the plan. This goes down to like, I think, say Lubbock or Abilene, something like that, down in Texas right there. So, but anyway, that is the interstate system. Autumn of 56. The Hungarian Revolution of 1956 was a revolt against the communist regime of Hungary. Civilians and patriotic soldiers combined to defeat the Jewish-dominated secret police. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev and his gang were stunned. The Soviets considered withdrawing all troops as the rebels waited anxiously for the anti-communist West to send weapons. A group of heroic Spanish pilots attempted to fly supplies to the freedom fighters. Their plan required fueling. In West Germany, Prince Michael Sturda of Romania, in his book Betrayed by Rulers, explained what happened. The Eisenhower government intervened immediately in Madrid, Spain, and Bonn, Germany. Bonn was the capital of West Germany. With all means of pressures and its command, demanding that the German government cancel the authorization already granted. On November the 2nd, Eisenhower's State Department also cabled the communist Tito of Yugoslavia. The government of the United States does not look with favor upon governments unfriendly to the Soviet Union on the border of the Soviet Union. There were to be no weapons nor even any symbolic words reorganizing or recognizing the struggle for a free Hungary. All that President Eisenhower could muster was an empty and obligatory, "Our hearts go out to the people of Hungary." 2 days later, realizing that Stalin's favorite American general from World War II was greenlighting the reconquest of Hungary, the Soviets, who had been ready to give up Hungary, invaded and crushed the anti-communist uprising. The leaders of the Hungarian revolt were then executed. I shake my head in disbelief. again, with the full force of the globalist PRC behind him, Eisenhower crushed the CFR co-conspirator Adlai Stevenson in an even larger landslide than the one in 1952. The final score, Eisenhower, 457 electoral votes and Stevenson, 73 electoral votes. However, the historic landslide had no effect in helping Republicans to gain ground in either the Senate or House, where they actually lost two seats in each body. One political cartoon, which we have been unable to locate now, depicted high-flying Eisenhower swinging on a trapeze as desperately falling Republican candidates come up short as they grasp for his coattails. This marks the first and only time in American history that a sitting president was reelected by such an overwhelming margin, while his party lost seats in Congress, again by design, with Eisenhower's assistance. Man, that's nuts. That's freaking crazy. I don't know. It just makes me sick thinking about what Eisenhower did. The more I get into this, the more I when it says I don't like Ike, boy, that's a very fitting title for this book. So there's about 50 pages left. And I'm going to call it a night for tonight. My eyes are just giving me, they're giving me a hard time, which I'm sure a lot of you could probably, if you're following along on screen, you could probably see that I was messing up a little bit. So I'm going to go ahead and call it a night and let you guys go. And I will see you tomorrow for the Constitution class and for the Tuesday with Mike. I don't know what we're talking about tomorrow night. I still don't know yet. So I think we may have said it last week and I forgot. But anyway, that is tomorrow at 5 p.m. Pacific and 8 Eastern. So I will see you guys manana. The swamp is older. Yeah. Trying to teach my mom to use laptop to do TV. Oh, that sounds fun. That sounds really fun. All right, guys, enjoy the remainder of your evening, and I will see you mañana. Good night.